The relatively sudden conversion of so many nobles to Protestantism is probably best explained in terms of clientage. No nobleman could expect to be admitted to court, to the church, to the army, or to administration without the support of a patron. And thus, if a major nobleman converted to Protestantism, he would tend to carry all of his clients with him. At the very apex of the aristocratic pyramid, it's pretty clear that opportunism and political ambition were important. During the 1560s, Huguenots would be headed politically by a certain Louis de Bourbon, the Prince of Condé. Calvin himself described Condé as debauched by ambition. Now, having set out the theology and structure of the Calvinist Church, I'd like to talk about its relations with the majority religion, the Roman Catholic religion, and it was an unfortunate relationship. During the 1520s and the 1530s, the Roman Catholic Church was a kind of house divided in France. It didn't have clear boundaries of orthodoxy, and the crown itself was in a kind of ambiguous position. The traditional enmity of France to the Catholic Habsburg often inclined the crown to support, or at least to stay on good terms with German Protestants, and Francis I, who was king of France between 1515 and 1547, saw himself as a patron of humanist scholars, and he was reluctant to persecute those among them who inclined towards Protestantism. Now, of course, neither the monarchy nor any other authority wanted to be seen as condoning heresy, but there was intensive debate over how to define heresy and how seriously it was to be punished. In the end, at least in the 1520s and 1530s, the judges, the king, and the bishops tended to see the matter in terms of the need to preserve public peace and in terms of the need to preserve scandal. To prevent scandal. If either were threatened, there would be some kind of short and sharp repression, but it usually only lasted for a short period of time. Now, during the 1540s, and especially during the 1550s, this changed, and we see an intensification of tension as a result of two related trends. The first of these is the growth of established Protestant churches. Calvin himself sharply differentiated a so-called community of believers from a so-called gathered church, and the latter, which was the ideal, needed a preaching ministry, it needed a pattern of worship, it needed a catechism, and of course it needed discipline. At first, the Calvinists in Geneva played little or really no part in the organization of churches in France. But by 1554, Calvin was actively advising French Calvinists on how to gather a church. He did advise them not to rush things, to meet quietly, to meet in secret. But it was always the case, in Calvin's mind, that to try to establish a church without the foundation of discipline would raise the danger of contamination by papal superstition and would separate those Calvinists from true faith in Christ. Therefore, after 1555, Geneva began sending out ministers to the growing Huguenot community in France. Between 1555 and 1562, we know of almost 100 ministers who were sent out to the churches in France. And in 1559, the French Calvinist churches were so well organized that they were able to hold a national synod, despite the fact that this was illegal. And the synod endorsed two documents, a confession of faith, and again, of course, a statement of discipline. Now, the second main trend of the 1540s and the 1550s, which was a predictable accompaniment to the growth of established Protestant churches, was an intensification of repression. Between 1539 and 1542, three important royal edicts clarified a lot of jurisdictional problems about heresy, and crucially, it transferred jurisdiction over these cases from ecclesiastical tribunals, which tended to be rather mild, to secular tribunals, which were much more willing to resort to brutal punishments. The reason for this is fairly clear. Protestantism was increasingly being seen as politically subversive. It wasn't just a religious problem, it was seen as subversive of the basic bonds which held French society together. Therefore, heresy trials after 1542 tended to be less concerned with what people actually believed and more concerned with what they had done to disrupt public order. It also tended to broaden the definition of heresy, which could now include iconoclasm, that is to say, the destruction of religious images. It could include any kind of secret meeting, the sale and distribution of heretical books, all sorts of things like that. The records of the French courts which prosecuted heresy are incomplete, and we don't know, therefore, how many people were actually prosecuted for heresy. But it is pretty clear from surviving documentation that between 1520 and about 1560, at least 5,000 people, although probably fewer than 8,000 people, were investigated for heresy. The range of punishments to which they were subjected varied. Some of them were punishments were fairly innocuous, a public censure, a fine. It might range up to the confiscation of goods and property, or more serious punishments like flogging, banishment to the galleys, or even death.